Welcome to the Science Metaverse Podcast. I'm your host, Keita Funakawa.
And I'm your host, Steve McCloskey.
Cool. So much has happened in the last 2 weeks. I know that tech YouTubers like MKBHD call September Techtember because of all the gadgets that get announced. And of course, in the XR industry, traditionally Meta announces their stuff in the fall, sometimes September, sometimes in October. But it feels like this is the first year where Techtember's really hit, specifically in September, within the XR industry. Because, as you'll see, we're going to talk about the new PSVR hands-on impressions. We're going to talk about Pico Neo 4. So those are some big news there. But the first kind of story is PSVR 2 and first impressions. Steve, did you check out those videos about the PSVR 2?
So I saw a little bit about the PSVR 2. I think it looks like a pretty cool headset there. Obviously it has a lot more ergonomics compared to the last PSVR headset. I saw that they weren't doing backwards compatibility with the PSVR games from the first one, or at least not all of them. But this looks like a really solid headset.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be a little more harsh and be like, welcome to 2018, because it looks kind of like the Rift S. It has to be wired into, a beefy computing device. It's an inside-out tracking, which is good to see. I guess color pass-through does make it, slightly more modern per se, but it is not, capable of standalone or all-in-one-ing. At all, right? So,
like a PC gamer master race type of guy, where you're like, it's got to be PC quality or bust. Like, console's always several years behind a lot of what you could do on PC. So, I guess I'm not as harsh because I think it's kind of par for the course. And with how bad the PSVR 1 is, I'm just happy that they are improving it and that it looks like it's going to be, like you said, probably Rift S quality, but with color passer, which fills a cool niche. And I think that the more people you get gaming on these PSVR devices, just the more popular people are going to be, using VR. So I think it's a positive step. Is it perfect? No. Is it standalone? No. But when is Sony been great with standalones? Yeah, they had the PSP back in the day, but when are we going to be getting a PSVR portable? I don't know. It could be
PS Vita R? All right. but I mean, I guess like to your note about consoles being a couple years behind, like I would argue that the Quest 2 is a console, right? And like that was released 2 years ago, right? So I guess that the lack of standalone-ness, I mean, like, yeah, Quest 2, like, yes, there is the Link capability, but aside from that, like, it is an all-in-one console, right? So like, I expected kind of
Sony's
a little bit.
Like they're trying to sell more PS5s, right? So like, they're trying to get more people buying the consoles. So I think like a console-centric ecosystem makes sense for them and their model.
Yeah.
Because then they'd have to get into like Qualcomm chips and this whole compact manufacturing with like batteries, and it's pretty much like making a cell phone, which I know the Ericsson didn't really do too well, so Sony has had some experience with that. They're good with the console and they're leaning into that, and they're creating a VR headset for the console. So I think it's all positive. It's just for the people that really like console stuff.
Yeah, I guess I definitely think it's a positive. It's great that Meta is getting competition and that like there's more players seriously being involved. Like the one thing for sure is that PSVR 1 like wasn't just an offshoot, R&D project that got happens to be commercialized. Like it was actually a real first iteration for Sony. To venture into XR and VR, and it seems like they're actually pursuing that, which is really nice. But I I can't I guess, you know, in terms of my expectations though, like I did expect a little more because, you know, even though the actually Ericsson didn't do well, the Xperia as a phone is actually doing fairly well in Japan. And Xperia, like from a specs perspective, like they knock it out of the park when it comes to being a really solid Android phone. And so, you know, I thought that Sony could execute on this kind of, you know, checkmark based XR device, right? That could also do some standalone stuff or something like that. But maybe it sounds like my expectations were indeed too high in that respect.
Yeah, because you got to worry about like the weight. Like I think they really went for ergonomics and like you got to make the thing pretty lightweight. When you add the battery and the chip and everything, you add a lot of headset weight. But yeah, it looks like they're still doing inside out positional tracking on the headset for the controllers. Sorry, I guess it's not inside out, but yeah, using the headset cameras to do the tracking. I thought the wrist rings were kind of silly because, you know, sometimes people grab the Quest controllers and they try to like put their hand through the ring. And we're like, whoa, like just, you know, grab the side. Like it's all right. You don't need to. But with the PSVR 2 controllers, you do put your hand through the ring. And I think that's just like so funny. It's been the meme of like what not to do. But now for these controllers, specifically, it is what you should be doing to use them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think another big thing, like a lot of people were on Reddit, at least, were saying about like how they really want to see Half-Life Alyx like being ported. You know, I don't know if Valve will let that happen. I doubt it. But, you know, yeah, like because, you know, the problem was that Half-Life Alyx is such a good game, but, you know, it's so hard to experience because you need to have PCBR and like, you know, the PS5 is such a powerful machine that you could totally run a game like Half-Life Alyx that, you know, now the quote-unquote masses that are non-PC VR folks can finally experience, right? So, like, from that respect, I do like that idea, is that it's more of a, you know, I guess, like a general population-friendly PC VR device in that sense.
Yeah, well, I think the controllers, again, just to kind of harp on that, like it's cool because the way they design the controllers, you could probably make it compatible with a lot of other titles because like the same layout. But of course, they go with the triangle square on the left and then the X and the circle on the right. And so it mimics like the whole AB thing that other controllers do. But it's, you know, sort of the PlayStation version, but they're all in the same location. So it should make, you know, porting between different devices better for developers,
which is super sick, by the way. Like it, you know, the fact that they're actually doing it with the middle finger grip button, like, you know, I'm very, very glad to see that. And that there's actual real support in that sense of you know, OpenXR, you know, compatibility. I feel like they're kind of hinting at that from like a developer perspective. Sony, if you're listening, we'll take dev kits. Both of, you know, we'll take a free PS5 and a PSVR. You know, in terms of the kind of the science metaverse impact and implications, I think we've talked about this before, but, you know, we've heard of like pharma companies buy a bunch of PS3s for, you know, a pure Blu-ray, right? Like the PS3 was a groundbreaking device in so many ways, but like one of the ways in which it got real huge popular demand was because it was only one of the few devices that you could get a fairly cheap Blu-ray player that happened to also play really awesome Sony games, right? And so that was one of the reasons why the PS3 was fairly popular and even among enterprise. And so, you know, in research settings, right? And so, you know, I could see a similar scenario happening with like VR being kind of like, you know, I guess in this analog, the Blu-ray, if you will, technology, right? And then that happens to also play fairly good games.
I mean, people are also making little like PS3 clusters of you know, a bunch of them to kind of make a cheap supercomputer, which is kind of cool too. So yeah, you know, companies have had some experience having, you know, PlayStations for professional use, and you know, will people buy a PSVR 5 in order to you know, get the PSVR 2 and then look at molecules with nano? You know, maybe if you're interested in that, you know, please shoot us a message. Let us know that, you know, that is something that you're interested in.
Yep, definitely. So speaking of headsets, on to the next story, which is about Pico Neo, which is owned by ByteDance, another social media giant who, of course, owns TikTok, is launching a new headset called the Pico Neo 4 and the Pico Neo 4 Pro. And so super excited to see this. I mean, you know, speaking of all-in-one standalone devices, right? The Pico Neo 4 is, it does actually look like a formidable Quest competitor. You know, whether that's competing with the, you know, the Quest 2 or their future devices is, you know, jury's still out there, but really interesting to see these specs and having a real kind of competitor enter the space, especially in the all-in-one device kind of category. But yeah, Steve, what were your first impressions?
Well, it's only launching in what, Asia and Europe right now. So, you know, I don't know when it's really going to be available for people in the US market. You know, maybe that's related to the whole ByteDance, you know, Chinese government situation happening between the American government. Or if it's something else, yeah, maybe they think that the market's already been saturated by Meta and the Oculus Quest headsets. So we'll see. But I think it's, you know, interesting for a headset. I'd have to try it out. You know, the Pico Neo 3 felt like an almost Quest. Like it was pretty good, but, you know, just a little bit off in certain areas. So the Pico Neo 4, you know, it looks sleek. It looks thin, you know, supposedly really lightweight. You know, how's the software going to be? Like, I feel like software is a very big gap. Like, you can make good hardware, but without good software, it's not going to be a great user experience. Controllers, again, follow that similar, you know, mode standardization that, you know, most of the controllers have been going to. Seems like it's powered by the same, you know, Snapdragon XR2 processor that the Meta Quest 2 already uses and the Vive Focus 3. So, how much could you do with form factor, really? Like, I think that there's a big area of improvement, you know, that we're seeing with, you know, some of the other headsets that have been kind of talked about online. But it's cool that, you know, they did a big drop with all these renders and photos of it because it looks really ergonomic. So I'd say it's probably the biggest thing I'm interested in is the ergonomics of this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, what's fascinating is it seems like there's this industry trend to go to pancake lenses, which again has all kinds of benefits from a, you know, like the optics perspective, but also, like, you know, having it lighter weight, right? So that's interesting to see. You know, another thing that I was really excited about was the support of color pass through. So that was really awesome to see as well. You know, we're huge fans of color pass through. The Vario XR3 is like one of the awesome, like the best experiences you can have when it comes to, you know, mixed, pass through mixed reality. And of course the Quest 2 right now already has black and white mixed reality. So seeing that support, and having that more widespread is, something I'm like super excited about. I thought the ring choice was interesting. It feels weird and awkward, but I mean, you know, maybe it's not an issue once you get into, to VR, but you know, speaking of rings, right?
The, like fitness bands, or are you talking about like the tracking ring on the controller?
I'm talking about like the tracking ring that, I mean, you put parts of your fingers through, but not your entire hand through. So you know, now we got the whole spectrum, right? With PSVR being the whole hand, and then Quest 2 being not your hand at all, and then this being like kind of.
Yeah, yeah, it'll add some more confusion for first-time users, but yeah, I think people get used to it pretty quickly.
Yeah, and then I don't know if you saw the news about the Pico Neo Pro or the 4 Pro, which is specifically an enterprise one, which maybe, you know, might be more relevant to kind of the scientific community being used in, you know, lab environments and whatnot. But you know, it'd be really kind of interesting to see. I mean, it enables eye tracking and face tracking, which I guess is an enterprise feature. Yeah, it makes sense. Like, I think especially when it comes to like training and things like that, seeing where your users are looking, I think is super important. But you know, just being able to look at stuff, tell you information, I think is going to be a big thing. And so really awesome to see kind of eye tracking being built into the enterprise version.
Yeah, we've had eye tracking in different, you know, headset mods since I remember people would have put a sensor in the developer kits for the Oculus way back in the day. And so, you know, it's nothing new. It's been talked about for a long time, but the fact that these are, you know, coming standard in the Pro headset, I think it's just a really cool sign that, you know, as developers, you know, this is going to be more ubiquitous, that you could actually build more features that, you know, take advantage of the eye tracking and the face tracking. You know, especially when you look at like accessibility modes. I think that there's just so many cool things that you could do with, you know, your eyes and other input modalities that aren't just, you know, the hand controllers. You know, granted, I love hand controllers, and you know, VR without the hand controllers is just kind of a not great experience. But I feel like maybe in 10 years we'll think that about eye tracking. You know, it's like, oh, VR with just the hand tracking is okay, but you know, once you have all these other things, it becomes so much cooler.
Totally. Yeah, sorry, you want to talk about the fitness band?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really see too much. Just said that they had some like fitness trackers for, it looks like gyros, so like moving and shaking your arms and stuff. Like, I don't know if it'll work for like leg tracking, or this is just supposed to be like arms, or how exactly they're going to be implemented. But you know, cool idea. Kind of reminds me of like all the Vive stuff, where there's like a whole like Vive ecosystem with the tracker, and you know, trying to get more of the full body in there. But yeah, I think the vast majority of users are just gonna, you know, put on the headset, pick up the controllers, or you know, do the hand tracking and not even pick up controllers, and just go in. And I think the more stuff that you like strap on before going in, I think the less people are gonna do it. So you know, maybe some people that are like VTubers and things like that, that are just like living in the metaverse, will just absolutely love it and like deck themselves out and like have all the trackers. But I still think most people are probably not gonna be having the additional things on them.
Yeah, I feel like I thought I saw a clip of somebody having it on their leg, and it allowed for like leg tracking or something like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, for like, you know, VTubing and also like, you know, VR chat and things like that. So I think that's the main use case, but it will be interesting. I think, you know, the more of these things go out and people experiment with it, the, you know, the more use cases it will be, including of course the scientific use cases, which we're excited to see. So we'll see how this pans out. And speaking of color pass through, the last kind of bit of XR news that we had, which we were really great to see, was the fact that Vario, which we just mentioned, actually just raised a $40 million Series D funding to build a true-to-life industrial metaverse. So, you know, really excited to see that, you know, Vario's continue to go strong. You know, the industrial metaverse is interesting, you know, especially because we're talking about the science metaverse here. I think there's quite a bit of overlap between the industrial metaverse and the science metaverse. And of course, like, I think, you know, again, that crazy high resolution color pass-through that you get in Vario is just unmatched right now. So, you know, excited to, you know, see them continue to succeed.
Yeah. Congrats to the Vario team. Yeah, obviously hardware is hard and takes a lot of money. But you know, they've been doing a good job in terms of actually like shipping products and getting it out there. That is not an easy task for a startup to do. So, you know, 40 million, you know, it seems kind of like a lot, but I think in the grand scheme of things, it's not really too much when you're trying to do a bunch of manufacturing. But it's cool that they have good strategic investors that are working with them. You know, I think Foxconn gets a lot of, you know, mixed publicity, you know, given everything that's happened in different factories of theirs. But, you know, they manufacture stuff. And so the fact that they're, you know, supporting Vario, I think, is a sign that, you know, Vario has at least experienced people that are going to help them with their manufacturing, most likely, and, you know, be able to help them get their products to market better. So that's kind of cool. You know, they also had the Volvo folks invest in them as well. So, you know, kind of good strategic partners that I think they brought into the round. Obviously, they do a lot of car type of prototyping with these VR XR headsets with the color pass-through. I really love the headset. You know, it's great. It's kind of big, kind of bulky, but, you know, super high resolution. It does really great color pass-through. And, you know, does eye tracking. So, you know, really has all the, you know, great things that you would want out of a headset. And I think that as, you know, time goes on, they'll end up, you know, getting the form factor even better, getting the cost down, and, you know, getting these headsets out there to more industrial applications.
Totally. Yeah, super excited for Vario. And congrats to them. Can't wait to see what their next set, you know, the XR4, like what's that headset going to be like, mm-hmm. right? You know, disclaimer, we don't know anything. But you know, it would be really exciting to continue to see their progress going forward. And the last story is something that we alluded to in our previous episode, where the merge, Ethereum merge happened. And it went like super smoothly, which is like just kind of a, you know, industry, like, you know, real like industry breakthrough. And there's kind of setting the industry standard in terms of how these things, you know, upgrades ought to be like. And, you know, that was just kind of just a poster child example of what a smooth operation and transition that was from proof of work to proof of stake. And so really excited to see that. You know, huge step for blockchain and of course Ethereum nonetheless. You know, can't believe that happened. Steve, I think you were up, right? You saw it live.
Yeah, as live as I could be, you know, like, I was trying to follow all the latest, as it was happening. Cause I feel like it's a critical moment where, you know, you switch over from proof of work to proof of stake and it's like, all right, yeah, are we still pushing blocks here? Like what's going on with the network? And it was really smooth. Like it just went from, you know, the block, whatever block number it was. And then the next block got published and I was like, oh, it happened. It's happening. Like this is great. So yeah, I'm excited. It's just one step though. You know, like this was the merge and then there's like the splurge and the you know, the verge is like you know, several different steps that are all you know, gonna be happening. But this was the big one, switching from proof of work, which uses a lot of energy and mining on the GPU. Or different ASICs, and now is going to be proof of stake, which actually lets users stake their Ethereum to try to validate different transactions. So it actually uses a lot less energy, which is, I think, really, you know, awesome. Like, you know, a lot of people complain about the energy usage of crypto, and they say, all right, you know, like Bitcoin is using as much energy as Finland or whatever the latest example is. You know, like this can't be good. It's bad for the planet, global warming, blah, blah, blah. Well, now I think we're going to flip that conversation. You know, we're basically going to say Ethereum uses less energy than traditional banking. Like big banks are maybe the ones that are actually using more energy and kind of destroying the climate. Maybe we should switch to blockchain because it's more efficient. So me, I'm a utilitarian person. You kind of know that, you know, in every facet of my life. And so in this, if we optimize the system to just be more energy efficient, then I think it's just the inevitable future. You know, you're going to be seeing more people transition over to the most effective system. With that being said, you know, gas fees still aren't as low as where I'd like them to be. You know, if you look at sharding, which is, I think they're calling that the splurge, like the next big one, that should help with that. Obviously, there's a lot of layer two solutions like Loopring or like Polkadot, yeah, different ones like that. I think everyone 0x is working on layer two. So there's a lot of layer twos that are, yeah, these little, I don't know, side sub networks that are kind of on top of Ethereum. So I think in layer twos you could get, you know, really great economics there in terms of like low transaction costs. So I'm excited for all of it. I think it's awesome. Congrats to the Ethereum team. And yeah, everyone going to DEF CON in Bogota, Colombia. Good luck. Wish I could join, but won't be able to join for this year's DEF CON.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, right? Like it's really kind of the first of its kind in a sense that like governance and organizations, like, you know, typically when a company wants to do something, like they like hire some PMs and, you know, more or less go do it, right? But this was such a huge, like, you know, collaborative experience in the open source community. Like everybody knew what was happening, and it went down smoothly. Like, albeit of obviously there were delays, and you know everybody wants it to have happened earlier than later, but at the end of the day, like, this was, you know, the stakes were high, pun intended, and you know, it happened. What, you know, and so yeah. That's like, it's just like, I feel like people, like, there's the effects of the transition to Ethereum from a technological perspective. And I think that there's also from a cultural perspective, I think that's huge that, you know, a group of strangers that were motivated by a digital token were, you know, were able to come together and accomplish something historic, right? Without a central corporation in charge or a government in charge. And I feel like that alone, I feel like hasn't really been talked about as much as the technological implications, both of which I think are significantly, you know, crucial and important to talk about. But
yeah. Have you been following any of the ETH proof of work, like fork? You know, some miners, you know, didn't choose to go yeah. with the upgrade. Yeah, this happens, I think, a lot in crypto, right? You know, you get the Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin situation, and of course, you know, all the sub variants of Bitcoin that kind of spun out with different forks beyond that. And you know, back in the day, right, we had the whole Ethereum DAO hack, and then you know, we got Ether Classic out of that. So ETC has still been around and still is doing proof of work. But yeah, it looks like people tried to fork it again. I don't really know how the ETH proof of work chain is doing. But I think it's decentralized, right? You know, people could choose what they want. And I think the majority of people chose to go with the new merge network where you end up having proof of stake. And I think it's awesome, as you said, that this decentralized community of people got together and they made it happen. It wasn't just, you know, a company that hired some new product developers and stuff and, you know, tried to push us out. It was a community. And I just think that's, really awesome. And I don't know if you follow any of the stakers, but there's a really cool, like, staking community that's been actually staking for, 2 years now? It's been a while. I feel like with COVID, all these years just kind of, you know, merged together.
Merged. Intended.
Yep. But I think it's been a year at least, right?
In terms of like people that the ability for you to stake?
Yeah, like everyone switching to their proof of stake nodes that they spun up.
Yeah, I think, you know, around a year or so, I think is correct. I don't have the exact dates, but
yeah. So it was a cool community of everyone that's, you know, operating this little mini computers with their, you know, staked 32 Ethereum on them, so it's cool. Yeah, it's happening. I think it'll hopefully lead to even more decentralization as more of these ETH stakers pop up around the world.
Yeah, I feel like the hard fork thing is also like something important to note, right? Is that like, you know, like it's a lot harder, I think, in companies because of like non-competes and NDAs and things like that, where, you know, a certain faction of a organization can say, you know, screw you, I'm going to do my own thing. And it happens. It does. It's not like that doesn't happen. But, you know, the fact that like the pure free economic, you know, way of that happening in the blockchain world is like unparalleled. And, you know, you like the only time that happens within governments and not corporations is when there's like land, like, you know, when colonies uprise against their parent government, you know, with the US and Britain and stuff like that. And like, if there's no land to go, then that's really hard to do. And of course, I guess, you know, the South and the US tried to secede, but that wasn't a successful hard fork in that sense, right? So, you know, it's interesting that, you know, in the pure intellectual and government governance, hard forking is like, I feel like we're just starting to see what that actually looks like when people are truly free to be able to do that in a, you know, more or less infinite digital space, right?
Yep. I mean, you know, now you have a lot of chaos happening. You know, some countries just keep printing money and they have, you know, 70% inflation rates, things like that. You know, in the US, like it's bad, you know, but it's still, I guess, 8-9% inflation. You know, it's terrible, but it's not hyperinflation yet. You know, to really be living in a country that's having like year over year 50-100% inflation, what are you supposed to do? You know, it's like, yeah, at least there's this digital alternative now, where people could, you know, potentially bank themselves using, you know, blockchain. So it's you know, it's kind of cool that it's available.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm almost out of battery, so we should probably wrap this up. Thanks, everybody, yep, for joining this week's Science Metaverse podcast. We'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you in the Science Metaverse.